Hello and welcome to Liberty Southwest podcast number 11. Today is Monday, the day after 4/20/2014. And our topics are going to include, Eric, can you please fill us in?
We don't have topics.
We don't have topics. We're going to listen to clips tonight and respond to them as they come in.
I think the way that we talked about it was that everyone can, just throw out various topics that they would like to cover. And if they have clips, great. If they don't, that's fine. And they'll just kind of roll through it without any, defined list.
Sounds good.
We're going to cover.
Let's roll down clip number one, brother.
You want to do that? You want me just to start off? So I have a few. I don't know if you guys pulled together a list of items you'd like to talk about or not. I have a couple. The first of which is the potential. It's probably going to be more of an eventuality that Rand Paul will run in 2016. I recently saw some numbers, and out of Republican candidates, he has the second. He collected the second most dollars in his PAC, so Rand PAC. I think it was around 400,000, and then Marco Rubio was leading this last quarter, at least, and he collected around 550,000. So they, the PAC dollars, they are used for staff travel and various administrative costs. To me, those numbers frame out pretty well that he's up there, but it seems like Marco Rubio or Chris Christie or Jeb Bush will probably be the establishment choice that he'll be squaring off against. But I'll roll this clip and we can discuss, and if you guys have something you'd like to talk about as well, just chime in. So here's this clip. It's about 4.5 minutes.
This is Jerry Seib with the Wall Street Journal. I'm joined by my colleague Monica Langley, who's just written a very interesting profile of a very interesting player in politics in America today, Rand Paul, somebody most Americans hadn't even heard of a couple of years ago. The takeaway from your profile, Monica, was as much as anything, this is a guy who wants to be not just a player, but maybe a player in the next presidential sweepstakes. How did you come to the conclusion that's one of the things that's motivating him?
That's right, Jerry. Just even a few months ago, he was considered kind of a fringe.
We've gone silent, Eric.
Against drone attacks, he has taken
awesome.
Off. And right. It's We're not back. Just that he's taken
Try
off for that one
a
incident.
Bit here.
Yes, please.
My story shows. He was considered kind of a fringe politician that was put in office by the Tea Party in 2010 from his home state of Kentucky. But since his filibuster on the floor of the Senate against drone attacks, he has taken off. And it's not just that he's taken off for that one incident. My story shows, after reporting, that he is clearly wanting to be a player in 2016 and is seriously considering running for president. And you can see that when you look at his actions, talking to different groups and in his positions.
His positions meaning he's doing what that suggests the presidential ambition is lurking in there somewhere?
Well, he had called himself a libertarian and a constitutional conservative.
Which is pretty much what his father always has been.
But his father, Ron Paul, who had ran for president 3 times, was pegged as something of an ideological gadfly. So Rand Paul knows he has to move more to the mainstream to reach a broader spectrum of voters. So you see him reaching out on immigration now to say that he is for a path to citizenship as long as illegal immigrants are working in this country. He even went a couple weeks ago to historically black university, Howard University, and spoke to them about liberalizing drug laws. So he is reaching to a broader spectrum, not just more mainstream Republicans, but even striking a chord with some liberals and independents.
And I think to the mainstream of his party, most importantly on some foreign policy issues, because that's really where Ron Paul always was an outlier in the Republican
Party. That's right. For example, his father was against any bases, U.S. bases overseas. And he says he's not an isolationist. The son says, I'm not an isolationist. I am for limited intervention. Mm-hmm. But there is a need for the U.S. to be in certain places. For example, he went in January to Israel and actually met with the prime minister mm-hmm. and came back and said a very pro-Israel statement mm-hmm. that any attack against Israel would be attack against the U.S. So he is taking these kinds of actions that would show he is different from his father.
And beyond that, he doesn't deny that he's thinking about running for president. He doesn't say, I've decided, but he doesn't say, oh, I'm not thinking about that, which so many politicians at this stage who are trying to play coy might do. That's not what he does.
No. He said to me, I'm seriously considering it. Mm-hmm. I want to be a national force. He doesn't say, for sure, I'm going to run right. for president. I want to, but no matter what, I want to be a national force and I want to shape the Republican Party. And one thing that's not been reported is that he and his advisors met in December and came up with this game plan mm-hmm. for him to run for president if he chooses to do so. And they have mapped out all these actions, which started with a trip to Israel, which also has included reaching out on immigration, speaking to the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, speaking to minority groups, and other things which we have seen in the last few weeks, including the drone filibuster, to show that he is going to be a player.
So, Monica, the thing that most people want to know about a personality like this who kind of rushes onto the national scene is, what's he like? So what's he like?
It's so interesting. He's iconoclastic, but he's also very understated. Mm-hmm. You know, to go hang out with him, which I did both in Washington and in Kentucky, you know, he's 5'8", he's slight, but and he could almost get lost in the crowd, except now he's become such a big figure. People are yelling, Rand Paul for president,
but
we
love you. But
you
don't get the feeling there's any of that politician bombast and
none of that. He's not a backslapping politician. Yeah. In fact, when people try to talk to him and schmooze him, he's not a schmoozer. He will get involved in a very serious conversation about what's happening in Washington or government abuse. Yeah. He's very low-key.
So I guess we'll get to figure out whether that works on a presidential campaign or not, won't we?
That's right.
It's a fascinating story about somebody we'll be hearing a lot more about. Monica, thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
So it was a good clip, I think, that covered a lot of, you know, the reasons why you could potentially see Rand run. I don't know if you guys
Eric,
have thoughts about that.
To expand on what you just put in there, I sent a clip over to you.
Yep.
If you wouldn't mind playing that before we comment on this? I think it's relevant.
Okay, so you'd like to play this as well? Let me load it up. And
okay.
Here we go.
Over. We can't have an American people that violate the law and just walk away from it. So it's not over.
You first, federal government. I mean, seriously.
Yeah, I think there's an opposite thing to what Harry Reid said, and that's the federal government shouldn't violate the law, nor should we have 48 federal agencies carrying weapons and having SWAT teams. Can everybody decide what the law is on their own? No, there has to be a legal process. But I think there is definitely a philosophic debate over who should own this land. And apparently, this is what I'm hearing, the family had a lease with the county of Clark County for over 130 years. Arbitrarily, in recent years, the federal government decided they were going to override the county lease and they were going to assume control of it, but they never asked for permission from the rancher.
Right.
So there is a valid debate here, but I don't like to see things descend into violence, and I hope it'll go through a court. But if it were in a court, I would be siding and wanting to say that, look, the states and the individuals in the state should own these lands.
Yeah.
You know, 80% of Nevada is owned by the federal government. We need to get it back to the state of Nevada, so when there's a bunch of chickens running around or tortoise, that we try to protect them, but at the same time, we don't do it at the expense of people.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't quite understand either how ranching works in the West. I mean, I grew up, part of my growing up years in the West, we had open range where I was. It's impossible to have any number of head of cattle if you've only got 100 acres. So for years, a lot of ranchers have let their cattle roam over public land. It's been kind of an agreement because you need that to get enough, you know, feed for those cattle. So it's a fairly normal process. And that's why, ironically, you know, we pretty much have open borders, and there's a situation where a lot of ranchers down in southern Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, California are having problems protecting their own land. So while the government's up here sending SWAT teams or whatever after this guy because he might be threatening the desert tortoise, we got people that are facing real challenges along the border, and they can't get help from the government. And the sheriffs are warning against that.
And here's the other question about the tortoise. Apparently, this guy's one of the last ranchers left in Clark County, because Clark County's become more metropolitan and Las Vegas-oriented, so there's not as much ranching as there was 50 years ago. So the question is, if there's very few cows, are the cows really hurting the tortoise?
Right, right.
So there usually is some science involved, and everybody just assumes from the federal government down, they come down with a sledgehammer and say, oh, it's the cattle or the tortoise. Well, maybe there's less cattle than there's ever been, and they're not a problem for the tortoise.
Yeah, I would agree.
So we're hearing Rand Paul talk about what has been a controversial issue. A small amount of background for anybody who hasn't been keeping up with this. It's the Clive and Bundy Ranch, and essentially, there's been 200 federal agents dispatched out to the property at this point in time when he was talking, that had been dispatched out to the property that had tased the son of Clive and Bundy and pushed the pregnant daughter of Clive and Bundy to the ground. So it was an escalating situation. It has since been disbanded. The Clark County Sheriff said that they were going to drop the prosecution and the investigation against Clive and Bundy Ranch. So that's disappeared, but I think it's remarkable in talking about the fact that he is going to be running for president, and he came out with such a bold statement about something that's been as controversial as the Clive and Bundy Ranch issue. And I think it just goes to show exactly how passionate and how stuck to his convictions Rand Paul actually is.
I'm looking at an article. I don't know if you guys have seen this or not, but evidently Clive and Bundy owes more than $1.2 million in grazing fees that hasn't been paid for quite some time to the Bureau of Land Management.
Well, and his reply to it was, I owe $300,000 and I don't owe it to the federal government. I'll pay it to the county or to a school, but I'm not going to pay it to the feds because they don't own the property.
Okay.
So that's what I heard, or when I looked into it. At a certain point in time, the contract itself was breached or something of that nature. I don't know if you see that, where the feds stepped in and then he said this wasn't the agreement we had and stopped paying. Something to that effect is what I heard. But if you have something in front of you, says otherwise.
Well, that's why Rand Paul is so good. I mean, he didn't go to any of these conversations we're having. He says, I hope it gets settled in the court system, like it should. Any dispute should be settled in the court system. And what I had read earlier, that the federal government, the court filing against Bundy was a federal court, and it shouldn't have been. It should have been a state court, but I didn't read the whole article. I just saw something about it, heard something about it, and so I don't know, but it's
I think
it's good to see that Senator Paul would step up and defend, you know, the situation like he did.
I think that's the importance. Exactly.
The libertarian stance of it's the individual and the state's land, you know, agreements made before, but
exactly. Exactly. Regardless of what the actual topic is, he took that stance. Like, I'm saying it was remarkable that he went that route.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I'm pretty excited, and someone I was working with today was talking about how much they liked Rand Paul over Ron Paul, too, and I was kind of surprised by it, but If that's what I hear, it's a good change of pace.
Okay, so I'm going to throw something out there, and I would love it if someone was capable of proving me wrong. Here's the way that I see it. I see that there are many politicians that I believe go in the system with the best intentions. However, in order to get to the top and to be able to enact significant amounts of change, to be able to become the president of the United States, it's my perhaps cynical opinion that in order to get there along the way, you kind of have to lose some of your ideals. Not that all people who go into politics have bad intentions from the beginning, but by nature of going through the system, people maybe become a little corrupted. So instead of attacking every single individual, they're all bad people, every single one of them. They're just bad people from the beginning. Could we maybe give some credit to the system itself and how you have to get to the places you want to get to? And so the where I'd love somebody to prove me wrong is just to say, is it possible for someone like Rand Paul to get through the system without being corrupted by it?
Well, the premise is all wrong. The president can't do what you're asking the president to do. They can only have a willing Congress subside to make changes and just ignore it and make it look like it was the president doing it. It'd have to be a...
Okay, fine. Then let's say someone in Congress. I don't care. When you get to a place where you can enact change, by the time you get there, is
no one person can enact change. It can only be a movement that's such a groundswell that our elected officials can only follow suit.
Why are we in the situation we're in?
Precisely because of what I'm talking about. What Obama has done is just because Congress and everyone has taken a back seat to the whole matter, the media purports it. It's not all Obama. Congress could step in and defund anything. The check and balances are there for a reason, but there's a willing accomplice in a way that it just lets this stuff go through. And that's because that's what needs to be done because accomplice. Of how the system's created.
Define the willing accomplice.
Congress, the two-party system. Democrat, Republicans. It's the whole banter back and forth that while behind the scenes everything gets passed that needs to get passed and the country moves forward as it does just because of our whole debt-ridden system.
So then for us to have any hope, what I'm hearing is that we wouldn't just need a president. We would need a culture. We would need many, many people.
No, we would need someone like Rand Paul, like just what the lady was talking about, that he's above the party bickering, the politician bickering, the backroom deals or whatnot. He's talking about serious issues, and that's what an executive is. You need an executive that uses the power of the executive to push, to force the issues at hand so people have to vote and to make it public what they're elected to do instead of just offhandedly done in the secret night, Friday night dumps, whatnot. It's there is no executive that we've had lately in the last 3, 4, or 5 presidencies. I go back to Reagan is what I would say, that he was kind of outside the box. And that's why he was so loved, that he had to force the Republicans into certain issues. And Reagan was no perfect saint or anything, but he was the epitome of what an executive should be in the presidency, is in my opinion, that I've witnessed.
Did you read that article that I sent on to you, the political article that kind of went over the last 50 years of the conservative libertarian movement at all?
I meant to read it. I only went through the first paragraph and I was busy and I was like, I'm going to come back to it. So yeah. Can you describe it a little bit as a clip?
Yeah. Well, it's not a clip, but one of the interesting points in the article, it was a lengthy, it must've been 8 pages, was the fact, Reagan was basically spawned, or his movement was spawned out of the Goldwater, the Goldwater movement, which is very, there are a lot of parallels between the supporters and ideologies that the Goldwater movement represented to the Liberty movement or the Ron Paul movement. And Goldwater was really nominated by a hardcore grassroots libertarian strain within the Republican Party in 1964, and had no support from the establishment, and just got killed in the election by LBJ. And they blamed it on the libertarians, and they purged them from the party, and or tried their best to purge them from the party. And you know, there was a segment that stuck, you know, from a grassroots perspective, you know, within the Republican Party, and they gravitated towards Reagan. And one of the things that Reagan did very well was pulled together the different factions within the Republican Party. So he appealed to the libertarians, the social conservatives, what we now call the neoconservatives, you know, had a message that could unify the party, and, you know, eventually resulted, you know, in him winning the election. Now, what he did, you know, I think, you know, it's questionable if he stuck, you know, completely to those, to the principles that he proclaimed to believe in, which I think Chelsea was alluding to a little bit, is, you know, it sounds great.
Well, I think it shows the power of the bureaucracy and their influence they have.
Yeah, that's there. But I think what Chelsea was trying to touch on is it, you know, how doable or how possible is it for a politician to you know, stick to his core convictions and get, you know, into a position like the presidency? You know, because you have to pull together a bunch of different blocks, and, you know, you have to win. And, you know, do you sacrifice something by doing that, or can you do that and, you know, enact the type of change that, you know, I think we would like to see a Rand Paul, Paul presidency.
But yeah, when you become president, you're a presidency, you're the president of all, not just your movement. And so there's such a bureaucracy intertwined in the government,
yeah,
that it's you can't, you know, it's, you can't just start rolling everything back at once. The havoc you would have on the economy is, it would be so disastrous that you would end up losing your whole agenda or the ideology of whatever ideology you came from. Yeah, it would be such a disaster to it.
Yeah, it's more, to me, I don't know. I mean, I've thought about whether or not he can be successful, or actually can win this next election. And
Well, here's what I see.
Yeah.
I see if Rand Paul, followed by Ron Paul, I mean, Ron Paul laid the groundwork, Rand Paul is coming behind him. All it is doing is exposing the fraud of the two-party system. And this, if Rand Paul is going to be one of the front headers, and he will be denied the nomination. All strings will be pulled to deny him the nomination, to even run for president as a Republican, even though it'll be so mired in conspiracy, fraud, and whatever to enact someone else, you know, to come up behind him to win overall, to be the nomination. And it's really going to destroy the Republican Party, and that will dissolve the two-party system is what I envision. I really hope that enough people stand behind Rand Paul, and the Republicans will not allow him to be the candidate. It'll be the same thing as Ron Paul. Every little stopper they can throw in the mix to stop his campaign, they will do. And it will expose the party, of the corruption inside of it and the lack of libertarianism and true conservatism in the party, and it will destroy the Republican Party, and something else will be formed anew. And hopefully, I just don't even like the two-party system, essentially. And I just hope it just brings forth the argument of what is, and just debate it outside of party politics.
But I would love for that to happen, and I would so hope for the two-party system to disappear. However, I don't see that happening anytime soon, and maybe I'm a little cynical. But the entire point, I mean, we reinforce that just by saying, okay, so look at Ron Paul. I wouldn't consider myself, I'm a libertarian, and I wouldn't consider myself to be a faction of the Republican Party at all. I want nothing to do with either one of them, to be honest. To have someone like Ron Paul, and you look at his policies and you say he's a libertarian, but he has to run through the Republican Party, and even so, he didn't make it. And I do believe that there's value in communicating just how corrupt and uncompromising and disadvantageous the two-party system is to everyone involved. I think there's value in that, but I just really do wonder if it's possible, at least within the next 10 years, for someone like Rand Paul to make it. Do you think that that's a possibility?
I think it's a possibility, and one of the things I wanted to mention to Kirk when he was talking about the third party idea is that, you know, Kirk, if you're around in late 1964, early 1965, you would have sound, what you're saying is exactly what Ayn Rand said. And there was a debate between William F. Buckley and Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand said, we need to form a third party. This is hopeless. It's not going to work. We're not going to have a platform to stand on with the Republican Party to enact the change that we'd like to see. And William F. Buckley basically said, we need to work within, as libertarians, work within the Republican Party and change from within. So, you know, the conversation that we're having here is not a new one.
Seems to be 50 years old by your measure.
Right. Yeah.
So, but it's there for a reason, because there's a lot of truth behind it.
In American politics, third parties don't win. Period.
Well, new parties are always created.
The direction of the Republican Party has not been very effective over 50 years.
The system set
up. Well, especially when you have certain factions of them that are so resistant to any kind of change that they literally do not hear the words coming out of your mouth.
Right.
I mean, how do you ever hope to get those people? This is never going to happen. It's a futile effort.
Well, the two-party systems, what topic transcends both parties? Very few.
One marijuana legalization.
I would say in the mainstream, it's not a two-party issue at all.
Yeah, it transcends it.
No, I mean, it's neither side. It's pinned down to either side. But it's But my point is that in the public persona, it's the liberals that want legalize marijuana.
Well, that's the whole point.
The lady said
people on other sides of the fence, so that no matter what topic you're talking about, you can pull people in either direction. Instead of them saying, what do we have in common, they know, you know, here, this basket's associated with this party, and this basket's associated with that one, and people have to pick which basket do they want. And so you don't want them to have a whole lot of common ground, because then people can focus on the things they have in common. But, if we're going to go a little conspiratorial, I'd say the whole point of the two-party system is so that we argue amongst each other, we fight with each other, we don't connect with each other, we don't really talk and find, well, you know, I might have considered myself a Republican, or I might consider myself a Democrat, but let's focus on the things we have in common and work from there, which is much more constructive than look at all the things we don't have in common, and I'm not going to listen to anything you have to say.
No, but
I think it's designed.
No, we're not supposed to ever get to that common point create more government.
Right, that's just their point. Like, in we're the public eye.
No, but that's what you just said. We're supposed to argue, but government's supposed to have their hand tied to not enact bigger government, to have everything on the individual and to live your own life. And the prosperity comes from the individual, not as a collective, not as a government top-down system.
I'm not saying that we should start enacting laws based on what we have in common with each other. I'm saying that in order for us to agree how to move forward, we can't just be focusing on how we hate each other. It has to be, okay, I'm a reasonable human being. Oh, cool, me too. Let's talk about it and figure out how we can each live our own lives exactly how we want to, and we don't have to agree on what kind of lives we want to live. We just have to allow each other to do it and agree on that.
Hate, jealousy, pride, prejudice, whatever, it's a fact of human life.
Oh, absolutely it is. It just doesn't have to be a part
of our
government.
It's not going to go away. It just shouldn't have to bug you. It shouldn't have any impact on you. Why does someone else have any impact on you for that?
That's the entire point. I don't care if there's hate, pride, jealousy, blah, blah, blah. It's life. But you know what? Our government need not play a part in that.
So that being said, you guys, you think there's any viable chance that Rand?
I think he has a great chance.
Yeah.
I really do, because I think the groundswell, if there's that, what's the term that everyone uses in the internet computer age? The
paradigm?
No, when it gets so many users that it enters this.
Oh, viral?
It's not viral. Oh, but it's the same kind of terminology. I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact terminology. But anyways, but yeah, there is that always that point of where you can't stop it. You just can't do anything about it. And that's what Ronald Reagan did. You couldn't stop him. There was that big of a groundswell behind him. You could not deflect that. But today, with today's mass media and propaganda and the perfection of so, it is going to push the limits if they can stop it or not. And if they do stop it, they're going to be emboldened, but it's going to destroy themselves at the same time. That's just my prediction. I think either way, Rand Paul should be our next president. And that's just me being why Obama got elected, because he said exactly what Rand Paul will say too. But Rand Paul actually has the history behind him and the non-bullshit factor behind him. And that's actually believable. And what people are so sick of the nonsense from government that Rand Paul will transcend that and people will accept him and the groundswell will happen. But that's my whole point, that if he is stopped because of that, who knows, he could be assassinated or something. It could be some false flag terrorist attack to stop him. And that will, you never know. And that might be the end result. That could be their perfect out.
Yeah, things like that happen. So I'm going to play one more clip. This is longer. So if it seems like it's dragging on, just let me cut it, and then we'll move on to another topic that one of you guys wanted to discuss. Here we go.
Kentucky is Senator Rand Paul. Senator, thank you for joining us. By the way, hat tip for being the first 2016 potential candidate to weigh in on the Bundy Ranch. Sir, when you hear Senator Harry Reid call the Bundy family domestic terrorists. Now, what do you believe, whatever side you are on this whatsoever, is there any reason to call Americans domestic terrorists?
No, I think what we should all be calling for is for calmer heads to prevail. I don't want to see violence on either side. There is a legitimate constitutional question here about whether the state should be in charge of endangered species or whether the federal government should be. But I don't think calling people's names is going to calm this down. I think it's liable to stir it up. So I think all parties, including Senator Reid, should calm the rhetoric a little bit. Let's try to have a peaceful resolution to this. That being said, The Endangered Species Act has been abused across America. We have a lake in Kentucky they won't put any more water in because they're worried about a fish. And I keep asking them, don't fish like water? We have a bat in our state where you have to pay the federal government to use your own land to cut down your timber. You have to pay them $2,000 an acre if they find a bat on your land. So it really is government overreach, government gone amok with this Endangered Species Act. And here's the real question we have to ask the federal government. They say that Mr. Bundy owes some back fees. If he pays his fees, will they let him graze his 900 head of cattle? My understanding, the way I think I understand this, is no matter what he pays, they're not going to let him graze his cattle anymore. So really, we have to balance the needs of a turtle and the needs of man and the needs and the rights of property owners. And this is a real, I think, intellectual and constitutional and legal debate, but it shouldn't be about violence of arms. And I hope that the government will not be there in full arms and provoke a showdown and something terrible will happen. I hope that doesn't happen.
Well, isn't that what the stage is being set for? And maybe because of what Senator Reid had just said, he not only called the Bundy family domestic terrorists, the supporters, the people who believe in whatever's going on out there, if they're on the Bundy side, they're domestic terrorists as well. Doesn't that sound like he's setting it up for maybe some more military action, maybe bringing some feds in there, maybe having this escalate?
Yeah, I don't know what will happen. All I know is from my perspective, I have a legal solution to this. I have a bill that I introduced last year, and I believe the senator from Nevada, Senator Heller, is a sponsor of this bill. This would give states more control over the land and more control over the Endangered Species Act. I would like to see the governor of Nevada.
Real quick, there has been some, I think I saw in Utah and Nevada, there's starting to become a bit of a movement for states to take the federally owned land back and, you know, bring it under their jurisdiction rather than federal jurisdiction, which I...
Yeah, that movement was happening before this Bundy incident.
Yeah, but I think he's touching on that a little bit. I'll go ahead and continue.
And the state legislature of Nevada be in charge of trying to help preserve species, but also aware of cattlemen and ranchers' needs. Nobody in Washington really knows anything about ranching or grazing of cattle or the long history that's gone on with this. We need to take this out of the hands of Washington, but let's have a rational debate without violence, without incitement on either side. But I have a bill that would actually fix this problem. It's been in the hopper for over a year. We should ask Senator Reid if he'll let me have a vote on it.
Senator, also, you know, I know we wanted to get on a couple other topics, but let's just stay on this for another minute or so. You know, a couple years ago, there was a Delta smelt. Remember that little fish where they diverted the water from Northern California around, you know, where that great growing area in Central California, and really kind of jacked up prices for everything from bread to produce and whatnot, all over this Delta smelt, this 2-inch fish. Is government overreach just getting out of control?
Absolutely. I can give you 10 different examples just in Kentucky. We tried to build a sewage plant in a small town in Kentucky because when it rained, the sewage was flowing into the river and nobody wants that. So we tried to build a bigger sewage plant and they said we couldn't because it might affect the mussel population. So we had to spend months and months and hundreds of thousands of dollars to count the mussels and then they finally let us do it. But that's what's happening. The EPA, Fish and Wildlife, the Corps, they get involved every time you try to do something. And think about it. Everybody wants a sewage plant to be adequate so raw sewage doesn't go in the river. We all agree to that. But the EPA and all this crazy environmentalism has us counting mussels. And in the end, we do build the sewage.
You mind pausing, Eric? We're
wasting time, money.
Paused.
What do you guys think about... This kind of micro talk, when, you know, you talk about the absurdity of the federal government enacting these laws for certain organisms, and you sit there and debate about it, and, you know, well, this organism isn't that big of a deal. But to the environmentalists, all human impact is just a strain on society. It's a degradation, and it just, to me, it kind of feeds into that, but... So it's kind of a lose-lose battle, in my opinion, but maybe it just wins support in other areas, and that's just how you have to talk. I don't know if that, what do you guys think, if that's the way it should be done, or should you just argue as more of a liberty stance on the federal government should it be involved in this kind of stuff?
What do you mean a lose-lose battle?
Well, anything he's saying right now about the mussels or the smelt, or, you know, and he's not bringing this up. This is other interviewers bringing this up. Yeah. And it kind of drives the interview into this kind of sphere. It's, to any environmentalist, it's just turned into such a religion that any human impact is secondary to the life of the earth, you know, the circle of life, so to say, that any, you know, if we do this, we're going to, who knows what's going to impact we're going to have in the long term. And that's kind of the religion of the environmentalists, that how it goes, and they put human society on second tier, and, you know, we can adapt or do it or whatnot. So it's, you're not, my point is, you're not going to sway any environmentalist mentality by arguing in those kind of senses that Rand Paul did, and it was brought to the forefront in that interview. But, so do you think it's better to argue that way, that, you know, well, this is kind of the absurdity of the government because, you know, it's raising costs of living and this and that, and, you know, it's, but for the environmentalists, they all think that it's any cost is fine as long as we protect Mother Earth and the circle of life, so to say.
It's very interesting that you bring it up this way, because it's literally having that much of a disregard for humans and that much more regard for mussels is a psychopathic.
Yeah, well, but it's religion. That's how religions are too. For your type of religion, you don't care about other religions. Your religion's right.
Okay. So I'll say this as a joke to start off with, but here's the funny thing about environmentalism. I absolutely believe that we should be conscious of our impact and lay as little of, you know, footprint as we can. However, the interesting thing about environmentalism is that if you think about it, the world in its history has gone through many different phases, whether those are ice ages or ages where the world was, you know, covered with lava or whatever. We've seen so many species come in and out of existence, or we found bones that prior to humans even being here have gone in and out. And the environment has been conducive to all different types of life, and that changes. And when the environment itself changes, certain forms of life no longer can survive and other new ones develop, right? So if we're really concerned about the environment as it is today, which is much different than it's been throughout its history, right? What's so important about this specific stage? This specific stage, as opposed to all others that have ever been.
Because we do have a heavy impact.
No, wait. So here, yes, we absolutely do. However, if you think about the motivation, the true motivation behind keeping this specific environment intact, the special thing about this one, as compared with the rest of them, is that this one just so happens to be conducive to our lives.
Well, here's my point.
So rather than actually giving a shit about Mother Earth is going to be fine whether or not we survive. Mother Earth will be just fine if we kill ourselves off, okay? So the only thing that we're really saving by saving this particular environment is saving ourselves. It's not altruistic. We're not really that concerned with whether the oceans are blue and the air has oxygen in it, but more so an environment that's conducive to our own existence.
Yes, that's why libertarianism argues that you don't mandate this from the federal grandstanding government. You leave it to the local area that deals with it best. People that live in that area can choose what is best for them. Not the federal government, because libertarianism is localized, not federalized. So the federal government wants all this intrusion, all this. And that's what Rand Paul was talking about earlier, in settling in the court, settling in a state matter, that the federal government shouldn't have impact. It should be the state, the people that are closest to dealing with that situation. that you can move out of that area or whatnot, or you can live in that because you're happy to deal with that. So, sorry, go ahead, Eric.
I think when you get down to what he's talking about, you know, endangered species, that type of thing, that they're blocking developments of certain areas, or from what I've observed, and it ties into what Chelsea mentioned, the environmentalism is highly politicized. So basically, you have a group of people that, you know, maybe they don't want a building built, period. They just don't want it built. So they look for some type of species that's endangered and, you know, bring that up, bring up some litigation, you know, bring up a, you know, find that the species is endangered and try and derail a project.
Yeah, we see it all the time in bridges, bridges that promote a higher standard of life in an area, but yet it's hamstrung by federal agencies or any agency possible.
Or environmentalists, you know, they you know, will either push litigation through or a law through to define a certain species as being endangered, or find one that's already endangered and do some investigative work and say we have a rare type of mouse or fish or whatever that's going to, you know, potentially, you know, be killed off because of a construction project.
And yeah. They block it from the local area that wants that to be built or to be utilized. And then, you know, it's debatable still in a libertarianist viewpoint there whether the state could even have the overriding effect of it too, but is generally used from the federal level.
Regardless of whether it's the state or the federal level of government that is mandating protection over a certain species, I think what needs to be understood is that the natural course of history allows for the extinction or creation of new breeds of animals or organisms, and that's a natural part of the way things work. So if we're really environmentalists, yes, we can absolutely take credit for and responsibility for our actions. We can take responsibility for our actions and understand how we're impacting the environment. Yeah, and whether that's done at a state or local level, whatever. However, we need to understand that it's a natural course that certain things will become extinct because if things are not functional in their environment, they become extinct. Like the dodo bird,
You can't talk about this, that you're not going to sway any environmentalist, that you just want to just do whatever you want, destroy whatever, and let live what lives. And things will evolve. It's so destructive to sway any environmentalist to your viewpoint that it shouldn't be there. We should be talking about to bring it to the local level.
Well, it's the entire point of having conversation to be able to bring it out regardless of whether or not we're going to sway people.
It's what the fact of life is. That it's human involvement is so, it has consequences. It's coming from a civil engineering aspect. That's half the study we do is the impact on the environment. But you can remediate these effects. And that's what a lot of civil engineering does.
Part of the thing is there's a lack of understanding of what the actual impact of what different situations are causing on the environment. And people are reacting out of emotion rather than actual science.
Or they're acting out of calculated political strategy.
Or they use it to politicize something, as far as global warming goes.
And it's masked as an emotional endeavor because that's what appeals to people, but it's actually a tactical political strategy.
There's a huge difference between scientific factual
evidence and what they are spinning it as. The factual evidence shows that, yes, global temperature is rising, and yes, man has an impact. However, the percentage increase that man has an effect is so infinitesimally small compared to the overall delta temperature rise. It doesn't make a fucking difference. And that but, they make it into this huge, phenomenal political issue in order
well,
to
pass
their own agenda.
I mean, if you look at the actual impact on the environment from a Prius versus, like, my Honda Civic, they used it as a marketing tool to get money from people to have them buy a Prius, so now they don't have to feel as guilty about, you know, their car having an impact on the roads, when in fact, when you calculate the fact that electricity comes not just from, you know, fairies, you know, shaking hands. No. It comes from burning coal. And then the battery itself that's left over from the Prius that you have to dispose of when it's done actually has a greater impact on the environment. But because it was reliant on gas, They sold it to the environment, and they sold it to the people saying, here, you can buy your way into reducing your guilt about
the
environment.
They've shown the Hummer has less environmental impact than a Prius.
Isn't that crazy?
Well, there's
people make this decision. Oh, it's just so infuriating. It's like, instead of doing the research, like you said, and looking at the facts, you know, we can buy into whatever we're being sold as long as it lessens our guilt, instead of actually looking at the numbers.
Well, let me just read you something that came out today. A $500,000 study, which doesn't seem that big compared to most federal studies, but paid for by the federal government, released Sunday in the peer-reviewed journal of Nature Climate Change, concludes that biofuels made with corn residue release 7% more greenhouse gases in the early years compared with conventional gasoline. It kind of goes on to what you guys are talking about, but it doesn't need to be that way. I mean, competition breeds efficiency, and if people want a better environment, grant greater competition. Those companies will seek that out. It's just like military, the industrial complex. Every country in the world has to continue to develop new weapons because they cannot be left in the dust. If they stop, they will be left in the dust. That's why technology in the 90s and the 2000s here constantly gets cheaper and grows by leaps and bounds year after year, because every company will be left in the dust if they don't do the research and integrate new technologies into their products. All of a sudden, their competitor will devise such a far superior product that it will decimate any other company. So it's that rise to the best for public consumption. And if people really want, people, I feel, really want environmentalists that we don't want to impact in our environment. We want our children to be live in a great world, and we are. Our America has seen such a dramatic change in the last 100 years from the Industrial Revolution, and if that's the mentality people want, let companies do it. It doesn't need to be mandated. Let freedom ring.
I agree.
And the competition will breed success.
I agree, absolutely, wholeheartedly, and that's the beautiful thing. It just takes us being aware and voting with our dollars. So I'm a little cynical about voting with my vote. I don't know how much that actually makes a difference, but I know one thing I can do is vote with my dollars. So if I don't like the way that Walmart treats its employees, I'm not going to shop there. If I want a more environmentally conscious product, I will buy that, even though it might cost a little more. And of course, you know, I mean, if you make that decision every day, it's much more impactful than it would be, maybe that's a cynical portion, but as far as I'm concerned, I see a bigger impact if we vote with our dollars versus just the votes that we've been given in our society.
Well, let me give you an example, because this regulation that's tied into the environmentalists only drive bigger and bigger corporations that can utilize that regulation. So if you had cheaper companies and more efficient companies that are cheaper companies that degrade the environment, or better companies that help the environment, or are more of a sustainable model, people's dollars voting, and then you can argue against the people, not the corporations, the mindset of people that are willing to degrade society in such a pollutionist manner. That's the how you affect change, and that is not how the environmentalist movement is. And it's, to me, it's, that's why the big business is behind environmentalist movement and is part tied in hand in hand with big government. And in it shows in how they lobby and of in the money that's flowed to it by huge conglomerates. And it's not from the bottom up, it's more from the top down, and it fuels the whole system that these environmentalists claim to argue against.
Yeah, like I said, most of the environmentalist agenda is, to maybe I'm a bit cynical, but it's to stop things from happening rather than, you know, sticking to, you know, ideological ideas within the movement. Obviously you have, you know, people at the lower level who really believe that, but, you know, as you get higher up, there are vested interests that, you know, try and combat various, you know, projects, initiatives, and that type of thing. So I'm going to play out this clip, and then if one of you guys would like to talk about another topic, that would work. So I'm going to start it up here again.
On something that I don't believe actually is really endangered.
All right, Senator, before we have to go, President Obama this afternoon took another victory lap on the Obamacare numbers. He said there are somewhere around 8 million people who've enrolled in Obamacare. He was very confident in that number. Are you?
Well, about 5 million people got their policies canceled, so quite a few people he's bragging about, he just made them get rid of their cheaper insurance, and then he made them buy more expensive insurance. The other big question that we're going to have in the next few months is, let's say you have subsidized health insurance. That's great, but what if your deductible is $6,000? If you can't afford insurance, do you think you're really going to be able to pay for a $6,000 deductible? This system is riddled with errors and destined for failure, ultimately.
And at one point, I believe President Obama mentioned about 35% of the people who were enrolling were the young people, the invincibles that they were going for. And I also think the White House corrected him afterwards to somewhere around 24 or 25%. Which number are you going with?
I don't know the exact number, but what we'll find out is in the fall. If you don't have a lot of young, healthy people signed up, the premiums are going to go through the roof. My prediction is come fall, you know, the president's tried to delay that till after the election. But I think come fall, we're going to find out that all of our insurance rates are going to go up dramatically. And we can thank President Obama for that. Not only can't you keep your doctor that you wanted, you won't be able to keep your cheaper health insurance. You're going to have much more expensive health insurance than anybody's ever had in the past.
All right.
Gloom.
I'm so glad that that ended in that fashion, because healthcare reform, my goodness, well, if you can even call it reform. I mean, I guess, okay, so he mentioned in that speech, I think that it's key to point out, if you can't afford, you know, your insurance itself, what about if you have a $6,000 deductible, right? So in my experience, in my career so far, one thing I've done as well has been some benefits administration and different key parts of my, you know, different jobs. And you see the cost of the insurance plan. So I saw insurance plans with like a $2,000 deductible for someone who's under 30 at about $250 a month. It's very clear that those expenses are not attributed to my risk, but they're helping to compensate for the people in the older categories that have higher risk. Which there's something, you know, I get it, you know, the insurance has to cover all the costs, right? But then you see about $1,000 a month when somebody's like 50, 55. And just how expensive that is. And you think, God, even if you're 55, do you really have $1,000 worth of expenses a month? I guess no. What if instead you could just simply have a really high deductible plan and have an HSA paired with it, where instead of giving over $400 or $500 a month in anticipation for something that might be expensive, couldn't you just put that in your savings account and you use it or lose it?
Yeah, catastrophic health insurance, if you were to do it that way, probably would drive down a lot of maintenance costs that, you know, people don't really even factor in, like mm-hmm. going in for physicals and, you know, regular, you know, annual visits for various things, which are mm-hmm. much higher because of the fact that, you know, people don't pay for them out of pocket. They're just covered by insurance companies. Mm-hmm. And there's not a, and I think both the Pauls have covered this in the past, you know, how if individuals were to pay for almost every procedure out of pocket, it would drive down medical costs substantially because you have, you know, I mean, you just have a bureaucracy in place that allows healthcare costs to rise at a much higher rate than inflation. But it
makes sense because, I mean, if you are not linking the cost of your decisions with your actual pocketbook, then people don't take as much. Okay, so I have AAA, for example. Have I used it when I could have possibly gone and found a jumper cable somewhere? Yeah, I sure have, because in the back of my mind I thought, well, I pay for AAA, so I'm going to call them. Same thing happens with health insurance, where I have friends who get a migraine and have literally gone to the emergency room. The emergency room costs thousands of dollars. Now, if they knew that decision, they could either, you know, take some ibuprofen, cry for a while, and it was going to be painful, but eventually go away, or they could pay like $2,500 and go to the emergency room and get a pain reliever, they might think twice about it. But because we have a system where your actions are not linked to your consequences, that's inherently going to drive up the prices.
Yeah. Aspirin costs $50 at the hospital in Minneapolis. One aspirin.
Yeah, it could be. It
doesn't matter.
It'll be a factor going forward because there is a decent chance that, you know, even insurance premiums are going to rise as a result of what's going on, especially for younger people, because they're not able to get it, or the Obama administration put in a pretty heavy marketing campaign to enroll people under 30 into health insurance. And the percentage of people who enroll is pretty low, actually. And
because they did the math.
Well, here's the thing. Yeah. Well, yeah. Most people want health insurance. They want to have that coverage. But it's the cost is prohibitive. And then you tap that with a fine. And that's kind of the main source of anyone young that I've heard of is, oh, I don't want to be fined. Well, and again, I do want health insurance anyway, so I will forego the cost, even though it's going to cost me more than the fine, but I will do that because I want that anyway. So that's the fine is what's really pushing them in.
Well, people, I can speak to this right from now, a personal
right now,
perspective.
People will, hold on a second, Matt. People are better off just taking the fine at this point. But you
that's
know,
what I'm doing.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. That the want of health insurance is such an impact that if I don't get what I want, I'm going to be fined for this. So I'm it's a lose battle. So I might as well pay that extra ad to get the win.
Okay, so really, I completely agree with what Chelsea was touching on earlier as far as health insurance, especially people under 40, for the most part, would be fine with catastrophic health insurance. And that's not what is being mandated. You know, catastrophic health insurance linked with HSA accounts covers the vast majority of the younger set. But that's not what they're going for. They're looking to enroll as many younger, healthy individuals who won't actually need insurance into ACA in order to bankroll a subset of the population that can't qualify for health insurance because of either pre-existing medical conditions or a poor lifestyle. And I think that's what Rand was was talking about in that last portion of the clip is the fact that they're going to be forced to even jack up rates even more to cover that unhealthy older demographic.
Well, it's become a Ponzi scheme because it's not insurance.
Exactly.
It's prepaid healthcare, and the cost of everything have risen so dramatically that it's a Ponzi scheme because now you need more and more people just to fund
healthy people.
The people at the tail end are needing to utilize or they're supposed to get. And that's every part of government. But it goes back to what, and I don't know if I've said it before, but it's my theory on keeping everyone in debt. That's what I kind of alluded to it last week on this college stuff talk that the unemployment discussion we had, that it was, to me, government wants college to be as expensive as it can because everyone takes it. The majority of people take in student loans. They come out of college. When's the most prosperous time you could go out and create your own business, devise a lifestyle around yourself to utilize whatever education you gandered in your college career or your whole childhood? That's the time when you can utilize those that education you have gleaned to go and create a business, to create a helpful society that flourishes the culture around you. And because that's your passion life. No, you got a college. No, you need a job. You got to go work for a company. That's all college teaches you. And that's why college is so expensive, to promote the debt and to get everyone in debt. So they become a slave to the corporations out there providing the jobs. And the jobs aren't even there in the first place.
I can give you some perspective from a personal experience as far as the health insurance side goes. For the last 2 years, I personally had to purchase individual insurance coverage from a program through Medica in the state of Minnesota. It was called Medica Solo. So I had to pay for this out of pocket. I was a contractor for the company that I was working for, and it cost me around $141 a month. It was right around that amount. And I was hired on by the contracting company at the end of this year. However, that didn't stop Medica from sending along the new premium notices. And they explained that due to the new coverage constraints that my rate was going to go up, and they explained what the benefits were that were going to be added to my plan. Now, for the most part, the only ones that I noticed were mental health and substance abuse. There's probably a few more in there. However, it took my total plan cost from $141 to over $270 a month. And that was a direct impact. Yeah. And it wasn't, nothing else changed. It was just the law passing. So we're talking a tax of living, just because this bill was passed, of over $90 a month.
Yeah, but not only that, it's every politician can run on that in the future. Oh, I will lower your costs, just like Obama did. Everything was a lie, saying that, oh, I'm going to reduce families' health care costs by $2,500. Or, you know, you can keep your doctor, you can do that.
It wasn't set up in any way to reduce costs. I mean, if it was set up to reduce costs, it would have increased visibility of costs. So for me, I didn't realize, and the only reason I ever found out was because I had an HR duty on the side, was that the difference between an urgent care and an emergency room is the difference between hundreds of dollars or thousands, and I didn't think there was a difference. And how is it possible that I couldn't know the difference between a product or service that was hundreds of dollars versus thousands? Maybe because the system set up so that we're not concerned with the cost on the front end.
Absolutely not. Why would you be?
Because it's all passed along to the insurance company. So why would I care if I rack up the cost? Because I only have to pay $35 for my copay.
Why would you shop around?
We are not incentivized to cut costs. We are not incentivized at all. And why are we shocked that the costs don't go down? For me to get I went on the MNsure website, by the way. I was just curious to see what it would cost for somebody who's under 30, you know, to have coverage, you know, and I wanted to get the highest deductible I could to see if I could get something that was sincerely catastrophic coverage and then set up an HSA. That's what I wanted to do. The highest deductible they allowed me to choose was $6,500. And it was going to be like $120 or $140 a month. Now, me, I don't even have $140 a year in expenses. Why in the hell would I ever pay $140 a month for a $6,000 nothing else covered plan, an emergency plan? Why would I pay $140 a month? It's just ridiculous.
You wouldn't.
And I just think it's outrageous that as part of Obamacare, they required hospitals to provide, like, ratings, like, basically, here's a quality rating. This is a 5-star doctor or a 4-star doctor. And they required qualitative information to be sent out to say, here's the quality of doctor you're getting or the quality of the hospital. However, they had absolutely no requirement for the dollars. Why is it so difficult? I can go to a restaurant and know exactly how much a taco costs, but I cannot go to a hospital and have any idea about what an annual exam costs or a colonoscopy. Where's that menu? Why is that not part of healthcare reform?
Because when you're sick and you need help, you're willing to pay any dollar amount you have.
No, you're not. You're just fine if your insurance does.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, that's why you want
it.
That's the mentality, the mindset of why you buy
it. Exactly. A desensitization of the cost because you don't actually fork it out.
You're removed from it. You don't see what the actual cost is. If you had to pay out of pocket for your annual exam and one doctor costs you $250 and then one right down the street costs you $125, but there's no difference in their services, of course you're going to go to the one that costs $125.
You're talking about annual exams. That's like getting an oil change on a car. I'm talking about when you're sick. When your car breaks down, you have to get it fixed.
It's the same thing.
When you are sick, you're willing to spend any amount of money.
Absolutely all of it. And maybe you are, but even if I'm sick, I still think about, does it make a damn bit of difference if I go down the street versus in the other town? I'm not
Hey, Kirk, what are you talking about?
Talking insurance. You're talking about prepaid health care.
You're talking, yeah, but you're suggesting that 90%, no, not, I'm not even going to put a percent on this. What you're talking about is catastrophic sickness. I have time to call 4 clinics to find out how much it's going to cost to get treated for a cold. It's not going to be something.
When you're a 3-year-old and there you got 100-degree temperature, how freaked out are you? You will go spend.
Plenty freaked out, but I have no time. Yeah, but if you
want to do whatever it takes to get your child.
It's ridiculous to suggest that you don't have 5 minutes to make a phone call to 4 different clinics to find out how much it's going to cost in that scenario. That's ridiculous.
The lack of competition. It doesn't need. It's not set up that way because it doesn't have to be.
Right. That's what Chelsea and I are saying.
But that's my whole point. It's not insurance. This is just prepaid health care. But we're not.
It's an HMO. It's health management. It's not.
You're arguing the wrong thing. It's not the hospital's responsibility to do that. When the government has regulated how it is such and how it's tied into government as such to where they get by without doing that. There is no competition. And it's all subsidized. That it's not insured.
Kirk, we were talking about the desensitization of the cost. That's all we were talking about, was just the desensitization of the cost. It wasn't the actual. We're saying, like, what you're talking about isn't true. We're saying this is why people don't know.
You're raising my voice against me, so I just got heated in expressing it, but it's that.
I'm so offended right now. I'm going to go cry on a pillow. You
know, I'm not offended either, so I'm just. I regret raising my voice there. But, anyways.
I want to throw this in there.
Clip of the day.
we deserve our own clip of the day.
Well, the entire point is not necessarily what the hospital. I don't think the hospital should be required to do that. I mean, you could have, if I wanted to start a hospital because I had so much money and I could just start a hospital and hire doctors and nurses and everything else, it's not my responsibility to necessarily make it, you know, any better. But I think that the market should be allowed to give people the opportunity to shop around, know what the costs are up front, and I think it's absolutely BS that Blue Cross Blue Shield, if they get billed, they get one price. And if I go in and say, I've got cash, I get another. There should be some sort of visibility to how much things cost. And you know what? Maybe the market hasn't demanded it because the market, as we speak, is through a third-party payer. And because there's an intermediary, the person who is actually consuming the goods isn't asking for the prices because they don't give a shit. The only cost they need to worry about is their monthly premium. And so they're not demanding to know how much an annual exam costs. They're not demanding to know these things because it's irrelevant as far as they're concerned.
Yeah, but it used to be 20 years ago. People that actually did research that 20 years ago. What changed? The regulations and the infrastructure behind the system.
Absolutely.
It's not the hospitals that changed this. No, it's the government that changed this. It's the whole top-down philosophy that changed
it. It's not the government. It's the lobbyists. It's the lobbyists on behalf of the companies who have a vested interest that changed it. It was the government.
It was a certain sect of people that rose up and convinced government to do such.
You know very well that politicians are very pliable, and if you put
would ever dream up this scheme by themselves.
Didn't.
This comes from other sources, but it derived from government.
No, it's not derived from government. Government's a tool, an instrument. In this case, it's a direct result of private interest lobbying.
And that's the exact question I had at the beginning of this podcast, because my question is it possible for politicians to get through and not be subject to that lobbying, to not cave in the pressure of somebody waving money on the side? I mean, is it possible?
Rand Paul doesn't. If you're talking about Rand Paul, he doesn't take lobbyist visits, period.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, and that may or may not be to a detriment, but he doesn't take meetings with lobbyists.
That is why there's something called Paulites. That is why Ron Paul was so popular, and why Rand Paul will be so popular as well.
I haven't had hope in politics in a long, long time, but I have to say, Ron Paul first, and now Rand Paul. I hope, and it's. I've also been a lifetime fan of the Vikings. Okay, so we'll put that into consideration. But I do see hope in them, and so then it just makes me take that step and say, is it possible? Is it possible that a guy like this can actually get through and not be corrupted? Is it possible? Because I hope it is, but I don't want to get my hopes up again.
You touched on something, though. Why are you a Vikings fan?
Oh, just because they're the home team.
Because it's a supply that you have. Supply-side economics.
I think she's just a masochist.
Yeah, that can be argued for any Vikings fan. But, you know, it's just that it's a fun thing. I mean, it's not like politics. Politics, you have to actually care. I'm not just going to vote for somebody because they're from Minnesota. That's absolutely ridiculous. But sports are entirely different from politics, you know. It actually matters who's going to go to a federal level when that's going to affect change on the entire system. I don't care where they're from. I care what they believe in.
All right, so I sent out, I wish I was had the time this week to find a clip, and I don't have, what did you say, Matt? Audacity. I need that to download clips so I can have clips for this podcast. But anyways, I really wanted Marco Rubio's clip this last week about how he came out against this Syria, the terrorists out of Syria, and I thought it was very absurd for him to sit on. Oh God, no, I can't remember that.
You sent an article over on that, didn't you, Kirk?
Yeah, I sent the article out, but I wish I just had a clip on it. But he sits on the Foreign Intelligence Committee.
It was in the last week. It was in the last month.
And he knows what the behind the scenes. By sitting on the committee, I am going to hope he knows what's going on behind the scenes in Syria. And we have been lobbying in Syria through the CIA and other organizations to oust Assad and the Syrian government. And we have tried to go to war and multiple times now. And for Marco Rubio to come out and say that the new terrorist hotbed is coming out of Syria, and that the government cannot control their country, and that these terrorist hotbeds are in play, and they could attack our interests or America's heartland, is such propaganda, such fear-mongering BS that it drives me crazy, because this is one of the Rand Paul's primary contenders in the upcoming GOP presidential nomination candidacy, that for him to come out and say this crap shows that he is all in for this run in presidency. So earlier we showed how Rand Paul was all in. Marco Rubio saying this.
Kirk, he's leading all candidates on the Republican side in fundraising so far.
Marco Rubio?
Yeah.
Big shocker.
Yeah, and this is my point. But for him to come out and say this, this shows lockstep and barrel with the State Department, with the CIA, with the shadow government, that he is all in with them, and that he needs to be the endorsed candidate for this upcoming presidential nomination in the GOP.
And that goes to the age-old debate, doesn't it? I mean, I see that and I go, well, screw the Republican Party. They've never accurately represented us, and neither has the Democratic Party. Well, I shouldn't say never. Why would we want him to be, why can't we have a third party win? Why can't we, I mean, almost every single person I talk to, I should say, when I start talking to them about what really matters to them, it's not like, oh, well, I'm just really a Democrat. No. When I start talking to them about the things I believe in, I hear a hear, hear every time. I hear so many people who are so fed up with voting for the lesser of two evils. I mean, do you see how prevalent that is when you talk to people? The lesser of two evils.
No, I don't hear that at all. Both
candidates as being evil, and that they feel as though they're forced to choose between two evils, so they vote for the lesser of them. People aren't satisfied with either one of the candidates, but they feel as though they have no choice but this one or that one. So they vote for the one that they hate the less.
Any choice is a choice based on positive and negatives. There's never a choice that is 100% positive. And if you think that you don't know that the law of...
Exactly, there are plenty of positives out there.
Well, choosing a Bridge Jumper IPA for a beer for the evening? I mean, there's no negative there.
There you go. Yeah, I don't see a problem with that.
Maybe for that minute, you never know what happens next.
I'm just saying. There's plenty of circumstances that it's not always life and death and somewhere in between. There are gray areas.
Consequences to
most of the world is a gray area. Most of the world is not black and white. We convince people that it's only black and white because then they have to pick a side and then they have to be divided. But to be honest, most of the world is a gray area.
Absolutely.
In accounting, and I know this probably sounds bad, but when I really got intrigued by my accounting courses was when, my professor stood there and said, here's the deal, it's a lot of gray area. And I was like, oh, really? Oh, really? And it is. I mean, because every situation is unique. And it's part of the reason that being a human being is a beautiful experience, is that it's not all been done before. Every situation is unique and special and something to be celebrated, and that's why we value human life so much as compared to the rest of the mammals and fishes in the sea. I mean, it's a beautiful thing that it is a great area. And so when we start to dictate life in terms of black and white is when we've really gone astray as far as I'm concerned.
The lesser of two evils is the black and white.
Exactly, and that's why I'm saying it's bullshit.
So why don't, if you're so concerned about third party, why not promote Jesse Ventura?
Just because I promote a third party doesn't mean that every douchebag who wants to stand on the third party is, you know, capable of making a good politician.
What makes him a douchebag?
Well, you know, he's a great guy. I take that back.
Well, he's very the only one that's ever run. And Eric said earlier that no third candidate has ever, you know, done well. But Jesse Ventura is the only candidate that ever has done well as a third candidate.
Which is a testament to our distaste for the two-party system.
Jesse Ventura is offering to run for president right now?
Kirk, he was the ultimate Harold Shudlick. The ultimate...
you really think so?
Yeah, basically...
Did Minnesota governance fail around us under Jesse Ventura?
No, absolutely.
Failed on the Republican, the two-party system between the Democrats and Republicans. They both hated him. He was a third party. They needed to oust him because he was not a part of the club. So both parties, we both grew up as Republicans or Democrats. None of us were libertarians when we were growing up under Jesse Ventura. So we all have this little distaste about him. But he arose because of the disdain. He was the first person I ever voted for.
He was none of the above.
And it was the disdain of the two-party system why he won in Minnesota and why he would win. And because when I hear him talk about his presidential run, you know, if he would do it, people do a legwork behind him.
There's a really good chance he will run.
Well, exactly. In my opinion, he would have a very good chance of winning because it's against the two-party system. Exactly what we've been talking about tonight. But as we talk, we're sitting here degrading him, calling him all sorts of names just to hear his name.
But
he wouldn't be a part of the establishment of either sides. You wouldn't even have this conspiracy theory behind him. But both sides would purport the conspiracy behind him that, you know, he's helping the other side. You know, he's aligned with the Democrats. No, he's aligned with the Republicans. This and that. It would just be a constant BS with the media. But it was, I think if he was to run, he'd actually have a decent chance. Let's say it boils down to Hillary Clinton and Marco Rubio, which I think I would probably end up voting for Jesse Ventura the second time in my life.
there's a good chance.
Just big feedback right now. And Eric, I know you've been trying to cut in, but it's it kept cutting out every time you were trying to cut in, and that's why I kept talking, because I don't know if something's wrong.
So you just err on the side of talking?
Yes.
Is anybody surprised by that?
Our good
friend Kirk.
Yeah, that'll be that could be an interesting dynamic if you... You know, it certainly looks like the establishment Republican picks will be Marco Rubio or Chris Christie, Jeb Bush, and the conservative libertarian pick Rand Paul, and, you know, probably Hillary Clinton will be the Democratic nominee, and then Jesse, you know, whoever he decides.
But Jesse Ventura would be something totally different. Is that me?
He'll be independent.
So, Jesse Ventura, he would not even run as a libertarian or anything. He would just be I am non-party. And that, I think, would appeal to a lot of people.
Yeah, he could... I don't know. He, to me, he could be kind of like a Ross Perot type of
Yeah, thing. Exactly. What say if Rand Paul was, like we were saying earlier, was running away with it.
Yeah.
And they couldn't stop it, so they all of a sudden allow Jesse Ventura to get in. Like, oh yeah, we'll loosen the reins here and allow this third-party candidate to, or third candidate in this discussion.
The thing about
see what happens.
The thing about Jerry is he's very sympathetic.
Feedback.
What's that?
We're getting loud feedback again here. I don't know what's going on. Someone doesn't have their microphone plugged in all the way in.
Is it from me? Do you hear it now?
No.
Okay. The thing about Jesse, he's very sympathetic to the Pauls in general. He spoke at the rally for the Republic and the counter convention in 2008. And my feeling is that if he really thought that Rand Paul had a legitimate chance of winning, he wouldn't derail that effort.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So that would.
And that's why I was surprised by his proclamation that if people did the legwork in all 50 states to get him on the, you know, in the debates, that then he would run for president.
I think
what he's always said. He's always said that I will not do it unless people get behind me and do it. So it's kind of a cop-out of doing the legwork that Rand Paul is doing. And so that's why I don't see Jesse Ventura's impact. That I don't think it'll be there. Even though there will be a lot of people that, you know, do the legwork.
I think if he saw Rand Paul as having a lot of momentum, he wouldn't just endorse him and, you know, put his support behind him.
Yeah, but why? If he really believes that the two-party system is, like he says, that is the crux of the matter, really having Rand Paul is not going to make that big of a difference because it's...
Well, sorry.
It's still only one position, one third of the power of government, of the federal government.
Yeah,
that's what I was saying earlier, that it's one person's not going to make that change. It's the system behind it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, people have to agree. There's a plethora of people that have to agree to it.
Yep.
And it's our representatives is what it boils down to.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what I was trying to get to when I said, so the question I had originally is that, let's say Rand Paul becomes president. How much of an impact can it have, even if we hope and pray that he can actually make it through the system without being corrupted?
He's
already through the system.
But he would need the house. He'd need the House and Senate to be much more supportive of his policies. Otherwise, he would just essentially be a pariah.
Well, that's why I said that he can't do change by himself, no matter what we would like him to do. He can only encourage it and trying to be the executive behind it. But the bureaucracy behind it has to follow suit, and Congress has to follow suit, because the bureaucracy can just give him the finger and tell him to screw off. They're there to stay. It doesn't matter who's president. That leads me
to my entire point then. So I feel like a lot of our time in U.S. politics history has been spent blaming one politician or another, but rather, why are we not focusing our efforts on the system itself? I mean, if we're seeing... Let's look at the approval ratings and the people who think that the government's doing a good job and really representing their interests. I mean, it's horrific. So why are we not focusing on the system itself instead of the specific politicians that might be in play at a current time?
Well, we can. I mean, there's certainly a lot of conversation that we can have. You know, as far as the unelected government,
like the Met Council in the Twin Cities here.
Sure, I mean there are many examples of that, right? I mean most of the you just have a thin layer of political operatives above a huge entrenched bureaucratic entity that is both, or not both, but federal, state, and local governments, right? So they're, mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you know, that's a huge conversation. It's a, you know, and there are a lot of layers to that, and you know, it's something. I think you're right. It's something that's worth discussing, and that, you know, but that takes research and really, you know, digging into those layers and understanding how they work and understanding maybe how they could be, you know, affected by either, you know, voting in individuals at a local, state, or federal level that could change those institutions. Because I completely agree with you, Chelsea, in that's the real challenge. I mean, you can talk about politics all day long, but most of, you know, what we're arguing about is unelected policy, you know, for the most part.
So maybe for another podcast then.
Right.
Oh, this is just a continuing talk of forever. I mean, this is the debate that should always be talked about. This is why politics should be talked in bars. Politics should be talked in wherever you go. I mean, it shouldn't be politics of a Democrat-Republican argument, because that just shuts people's minds off. I guarantee you do a study, I'm pretty sure I could find one out there that when these two systems are intertwined, that your brain just shuts off that way, and it's, you just shut up all argument, and you got to argue your side regardless of what. You have to be proved right.
Absolutely, and I 100% agree with you, and that's why it's been so comforting and so inspiring and so reassuring when I speak to my friends, people that know me personally, where we have a friendship, regardless of whether that person would consider themselves a Democrat or a Republican, when we start talking, we agree probably 90% of the time. And it's just insane how often this happens, regardless of what side of the fence they're on. I start saying, I believe in your right to live your life how you want, and I believe that you should then also tolerate someone's right to live a way against yours or different than yours. And so many people, when you really start getting down to the fundamentals of what it is to be a libertarian and what a libertarian institution would look like and what the legal system would mirror if it was a libertarian system, so many people say, yes, I'm okay if there are other people in this world that want to live differently than me, but it's totally worth it to live amongst them if I'm also granted the liberty to live as though I want to live and do as what I want to do and believe as what I want to believe. And there are so many people who are more than willing to forsake their differences with their neighbors in the sake and in the belief that we can live the way that we want to live. And there are so many people in that category. But when you get into the conversations with people, well, I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat, suddenly anyone on the other side of the fence is mute. Completely blind and deaf to anything that you want to suggest, because the second that they believe that they're speaking to the other team, if you will.
So no, they're not completely blind.
Someone who's a Packer, then I don't hear anything you say, and the rest of this conversation is just going to go as me spewing my doctrine and hoping that something hits, but I'm not going to hear anything that you have to say, because I know that you're one of them. And you're on the other side, and you're the enemy, and I need to bring you to the light. So that's, I don't hear anything that you have to say.
I don't think we need to go there. I,
you know, I think
it's pretty degrading to say to someone that, like that. I think people argue just because they think they're right, but I think that arguing in the first place, people reflect upon it in past time or as life goes on, and that's how you impact people. That's how education, that's how most education is, through mistakes, personal mistakes, and that you reflect upon it. So all of a sudden you argue so passionately for something, and then you are enlightened 2 days down the road or a week or a year that you remember arguing so passionately about, and you see something in a different light, and you kind of recall on this conversation you had that it's, you know, and that's why getting the information out there is so damning to the establishment. And this is what I would say, that through the mentality, slave mentality that we're been shuffled down in single file like fashion. But
in party politics, you do get a lot of the you know, this side is, you know, stupid. The other side is stupid. But that's at the extreme grassroots level, and I really agree with what Chelsea mentioned. If you talk to most people, and you don't even have to frame the conversation as a political conversation, you just talk about ideas, you know, that may be whatever in context, you know, their ideas of freedom and personal liberty. And you can talk to somebody who, you know, if you don't even bring it up as a Republican Democratic type of conversation, you can just say, you know, I don't think the government should be in this area or that area. You know, we should have, you know, the ability to do what we want, as long as it doesn't negatively impact another individual. And most people are going to, you know, they're going to go for self-preservation. They don't want to really harm other, you know, other people. And you can frame that conversation in a non-aggressive, non-coercive type of way. You know, in my experience, and that's really how I talk to people. I don't, if I come up to an individual and we're going to talk about something that's political, for the most part, I don't even present myself, almost always, as, you know, someone's a libertarian who's conservative. I just talk about what they're concerned about or what I'm concerned about, and don't present it in a combative way. And for the most part, I've talked to far right people, far left people, and I've found that most people just want to get on with their lives and not have, you know, outside forces dictate what they do for the most part. And that's the libertarian philosophy. And to me, that
exactly.
No, but that brings me to a topic that I wanted to bring up. That, do you like calling yourself libertarian, or that you want to be libertarian, or the libertarian philosophy, like you just said?
I don't care. I mean, it happens to
me. Well, exactly. The reason we say it more and more, it seems to me, like I've caught myself saying it more and more this in the last year or two, where it's, I don't like to say it, because it just ends up being the same Democrat-Republican thing. If, say, the Republican Party went away, it's just the Democrats and the Libertarians. It's going to end up being the same thing.
You know what,
but
I
it's,
do?
It's the,
I
it's
just
the
talk
philosophy.
To people.
I
didn't even know I was a libertarian.
Yeah.
I didn't even know, because what I would do is I would be having conversations with people, and I didn't cling to either party. I said, okay, I'm not a Democrat or Republican. I'm fiscally conservative, and I'm socially liberal. Yeah. And the more I started talking to my friends, I had a friend who went, you're a libertarian.
Yeah.
And I said, is that what it is? See, I didn't even know that there was a party out there that represented my belief system, and it wasn't until somebody said that to me that I went, oh, well, let me check this libertarian thing out. And that was like, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, and I looked into it, and I'm like, oh, that's it. That's what I believe. I just didn't know that there was a party out there that represented me, because the only thing you hear about is either Republican, Democrat, or independent, which is a big old question mark, and nobody knows what it means, because it's not really affiliated with any belief system, as far as I'm concerned. And so it wasn't until I found out that was an option that I went, well, that's what I already believe, is that we should all be able to live our lives exactly how we want to, assuming we're not raping or killing or stealing from other people, we're not screwing other people over and getting away with it. No, we can't, you know, mess with other people's rights to live their lives, but assuming that we're not doing that, we can do whatever the hell we want to in our own lives.
And I don't even, in the context of any conversation that I have, I typically apply a label to it, like Kirk was talking about. I mean, I'll just, you know, talk talk with people, understand what they're concerned about, and it just happens to fall, you know, in that camp. And it's kind of similar to what
Chelsea. Do you think it's degrading though, or not? I mean, to be put inside that camp.
From what I've observed, is that there's a potential opportunity, or a big opportunity, because if you just sit down, you just ring any type of party allegiance out of the conversation, and you just talk about what people are interested in. Most, you know, a vast majority of people that I've talked to are, if they wouldn't go through a test, or, you know, ask them to label with any type of ideology, they're libertarian. And
I would agree with that. Yeah.
You know, that to me is a positive. You know, if you want to talk about in context of a presidential campaign or a city council campaign or whatever in the political realm, there is a lot of opportunity there.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's, you know, I just thought it was fascinating one time. I went out to this restaurant with my dad, and he used to be a staunch, you know, Rush Limbaugh listening to Fox News watching Republican. And I kept telling him, I'm like, they're just as bad. And I kept trying to get it through his head. But we went to this restaurant, and we went out to have lunch.
I lost everyone for a while.
Hello?
Hello?
Where did we leave off?
Tune in, talk to
you. I lost everyone for probably about a minute or so.
We're back.
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
I guess.
Hello?
Did everyone can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Oh, I'm still here.
Can you hear me?
Yeah?
Yep.
Okay, so something. Hello? Happened there.
As you were saying, there were a lot of people out there that when you talk about items on a piece-by-piece basis will express opinions and beliefs and values that mirror the libertarian point of view, meaning that we can all live our lives as long as we're not, you know, interfering with someone else's. But they don't affiliate with the Libertarian Party. If you would ask them what party they affiliate with, it might be the Republicans or the Democrats, but we rarely hear the Libertarian Party, even though when I speak with them on an issue-to-issue basis, they mirror that libertarian belief system.
Can there really be a Libertarian Party? That's what this whole last conversation has been about.
Of course there can be. There already is one.
I'm one. Isn't this a libertarian podcast?
It's Liberty Southwest podcast.
This is not a libertarian podcast. Yes, this is all about liberty.
Yeah, this is just liberty in general. So.
Oh, well.
We're Liberty Southwest. We're not necessarily libertarian, Democrat, Republican, or otherwise.
Good to know.
Right on.
By legality and regulation, we cannot be affiliated to any party.
Oh, is this kind of like the UAV company I'm working for that says I can't refer to anything as flying?
What?
Because then it would be another conversation. Yeah. Well, because otherwise it'd be under the jurisdiction of the FAA. So we call them wing scan dollars instead of flying dollars.
Wing scan dollars?
Yes.
Nice.
Wing scan dollars?
Yeah, it's the thing that translates all the pictures into nice pretty graphs for the farmers.
Okay.
And so instead of calling them flying dollars where they fly the UAVs because it's $4 an acre, they call them wing scan dollars. And I was trying to figure out commissions. They said, no, you have to change your spreadsheet because you call them flying dollars. if we call flying dollars, then our UAVs then could be perceived as falling under the jurisdiction of the FAA. So we have to call them wing scan dollars.
Got it.
Yep. Yay, technicalities and overreach of government.
What's that?
Oh, it just goes back to the overreach of government, really. I mean, it's a little plane that's like 2 pounds, and yet it falls under the jurisdiction of the FAA if you call it flying, but it doesn't if it's not flying. It's just an arbitrary point that allows the government to intervene in a situation where all they're doing is taking pictures of corn acres or soybean acres, and it'd be illegal if they did it under the current FAA regulations, but if it's not considered flying, then it's okay. Just another example of the intervention, I suppose.
It's the bureaucracy system.
So we're up at around 1 hour and 50 minutes. Do you guys have any other topics that you'd like to touch on?
Like to just, I think it's a good ending point, which is just save for next time.
Wrap it up?
Sounds good to me.
All right, Matt, why don't you wrap things up?
This has been Liberty Southwest podcast number 11. It's been Eric Taylor, Kirk Pettis, Chelsea Camo, and myself, Matt Winter. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.